In 1956, 10 pence was 2 shillings, and it was still a fortnight's pocket money. And the 2 shilling piece we got from Mr. Tate in 1956 was old even in those days. Mr. Tate lived farther down the street, and everyone said he was a miser. His house was shabby and unpainted, and he looked miserable. That Saturday, we had 2 half-crowns. That's 5 shillings. All right, 25 pence, which Gary's mum had given him to buy a jar of pickle and some potatoes from the corner shop. Mr. Tate was ahead of us, buying bread and cheese, which he paid for with a 2 shilling piece. Mrs. Goldman looked at it very hard before she put it in the till. "It's a perfectly good one," Mr. Tate said testily. Mrs. Goldman held it up, and we noticed how black it looked. Then she put it in the till. Mr. Tate had been scowling across the counter at her, but as the till drawer closed, he suddenly smiled, raised his hat, and almost bowed out of the shop. "Now, what can I do for you boys?" Mrs. Goldman said. "A jar of pickle and 10 pounds of King Edward's," Gary recited. Gary handed her the 2 half-crowns. In return, Mrs. Goldman gave him a 2 shilling piece in change, the very 2 shillings that Mr. Tate had just given her. She was glaring something awful while she was holding out the money, because Gary didn't take it at first. We looked hard at the 2 bob. It seemed okay, but it was very black. "It's a perfectly good one," Mrs. Goldman snapped. We jumped. Mrs. Goldman looked really angry. Her hand, with the coin in the palm, was shaking. Gary picked it up and dropped it in his pocket. We took a handle of the shopping basket each and went out of the shop. We heard Mrs. Goldman call out,
"Goodbye, boys. See you soon."
"She's changed her tune," I said. Gary shrugged moodily. He was slouching, and the shopping bag dipped annoyingly on his side, so that the lumpy King Edwards banged against my legs.
"Quit shoving," Gary snarled, when I jerked at the bag to level it.
"What's eating you?" I said. Gary had been in a perfectly good mood 5 minutes before. Now he was scowling. The same expression he wore when Mr. Carter whacked him at school.
"I don't know." He looked me in the eye. "I just feel horrible."
We were level with his front door by then. We went in and reached the kitchen table where Gary dumped the shopping bag.
"Got the pickles?" his mum said.
She could see the potatoes spilling out of the bag.
"Got the change?"
Gary delved into his pocket and dropped the coin on the table and smiled. In that second, his whole mood changed.
"Can I have my pocket money?" he said.
"Already," his mum groaned. Only minutes ago, Gary had acted as if he had no more than days to live. Now he was grinning as usual.
"Oh, Mum, it's 2 weeks."
He was looking at the 2 shilling piece we'd got from the shop. "Okay, take the 2 bob, she said. Gary scooped up the 2 bob and we zipped out the back door.
"What do you say?"
Mrs. Sutton yelled after us.
"Ta,"
said Gary. He was down in the mouth again, dragging his feet as we crossed the yard and went through the gate into the back lane.
"Come on," I said, "let's go up the rec."
"I don't care where we go," Gary said.
I couldn't understand it. Gary never sulked, and if anything was bothering him, he talked about it. But today he wasn't talking, though I thought he might say something when he saw who was there ahead of us. In one corner of the wreck stood a pair of swings, and suspended upside down from the crossbar of one of the swings was Trevor Passmore. He was hanging by his knees. When he saw us, he swung down and strutted towards us. We stood in awe of Trevor, partly because he was a lot bigger than us, and partly because he said that underpants were sissy and refused to wear any. Now he came up to us and said,
"Bet you can't hang upside down on them swings."
Gary stared at him mournfully
and started to walk on, but Trevor dodged in front of him. "Bet you wouldn't dare hang upside down from them swings," Passmore intoned, lolloping round like an incompetent wolf. At last, Gary raised his head, gave Passmore a long, serious look, and changed direction towards the swings. "Hold that for us," he said, and dropped the contents of his trouser pockets into my hands. With one bound, he was swarming up the support of the left-hand swing. But I wasn't looking at him. I wasn't looking at anything. There was a leaden feeling at the back of my head, a dreadful heaviness. I knew there was no hope. Up above, Gary was dangling, yelling insults at Passmore. I turned my eyes upward to watch him. Poor Gary. Didn't he know it was meaningless? Gary lowered himself to the ground. He pranced over to where I was standing. "Wake up," Gary bawled cheerfully. "Give us me things." He held out his hands, and I dropped into them all the objects he had given me to hold. "That was brilliant," I said. "It's nothing," Gary said. The sad look was back in his eyes. He just sighed and turned away. I knew how he felt. Then I realized why I knew how he felt. I turned my back on Passmore and ran after him. "Gary," I said, "lend us two, Bob." Gary simply held out his hand with the coin in it. "Keep it," he said. "Go on. I don't want it any more." I flicked it out of his palm with my fingernail. The coin spun away into the grass and Gary shot after it. "What'd you do that for?" he yelled. "That's 2 weeks' money." "Wait," I grabbed his sleeve. "Don't pick it up. Listen, why did you give it to me?" Gary stopped and thought. "I didn't want it," he said at last. "I didn't want anything. I wished I was dead. I couldn't understand why I was alive." "I know," I told him, "and nor could I. While I was looking after your things," Gary looked at me. "While you were holding my money." The two Bob was lying in front of us on a patch of bald earth. "Hey, what say we test it?" I said. "We could give it to someone we don't like, just to see what happens." Gary was prodding the coin with a twig. "What about old Carter?" "Of course. Doing it to a teacher didn't seem quite so unfair, and there wasn't much Mr. Carter didn't know about unfairness." Gary stood guard over the 2 shillings while I went home for the coal tongs, a paper bag, and some string. We picked up the coin with the tongs, dropped it in the bag, and tied the neck with string. Then we tied the end to Gary's twig and walked back, holding the bag at arm's length. The bag spent the rest of the weekend in Gary's outside lav on the top of the cistern. On Monday morning, Gary looked pretty sick after registration when he carried the money to the front and laid it on Mr. Carter's desk, even though we'd put it in an envelope. I saw Gary swallow hard as he said, "Please, sir, will you look after this money for me till dinner time?" Mr. Carter took the envelope and shoved it in his pocket. We lined up for assembly after that, and we were halfway through Praise My Soul, the King of Heaven, before Gary nudged me and nodded in Mr. Carter's direction. Mr. Carter was slumped forward with his head in his hands. When we all stood up at the end and filed out, Mr. Carter stayed where he was, until Miss Lewis walked over and touched him on the shoulder. English with Mr. Carter was due to start at 11:45, but it was 10 to 12 before the classroom door opened, and Miss Lewis walked in. Gary put up his hand and said, "Please, miss, what's happened to sir?" "Mr. Carter is unwell," Miss Lewis said. A horrid thought struck me. "He hasn't gone home, has he?" I said. If he'd left the premises with the 2 bob. "I don't see what business it is of yours," Miss Lewis said, "but no, he hasn't." After the dinner bell rang, we hurried to the staff room, but before we got there, I happened to glance out the window. At the end of the front drive was Mr. Carter, just turning into the street. Without a word, we were off. Mr. Carter was well ahead of us, but not walking very fast. He kept right on, head down, shoulders hunched, and we realised he was heading for the station. Only he wasn't. When he reached the station approach, he crossed over it and went on, up onto the railway bridge. Now we were crossing the station approach, and we could see Mr. Carter's figure outlined against the sky as he reached the highest part of the bridge. And then he stopped. "Oh, God!" said Gary, and broke into a run. I ran after him, for up there, on the bridge, Mr. Carter had got one knee on the parapet.
"Sir!"
My voice had become a breathy squeak.
"No, sir!"
Then a train went onto the bridge, an express that wasn't stopping at the station, and Gary and Mr. Carter vanished in a boiling cloud of steam. When it cleared, Gary was holding Mr. Carter by the belt of his raincoat, and Mr. Carter was climbing down off the parapet.
"Oh, sir!"
Gary was as frightened as I was.
"Can I have that 2 bob you were keeping for me, sir?"
Mr. Carter reached into his pocket, drew out the envelope, and handed it to Gary, who took it by one corner, pinched in his fingernails. Mr. Carter looked slightly stunned.
Right, he said briskly. "Back to school. Can't think why we're hanging about here, can you?"
And he strode off without another glance at us. I suddenly understood what people meant when they talked about someone turning up like a bad penny. And so Gary performed the noblest deed of his life. He took the 2 bob bit, 2 weeks' pocket money, and dropped it in the canal. When we went home that afternoon, Mr. Tate was out on the pavement painting his front door bright red.
"Just a moment, lads," he said as we went by. "Do you remember on Saturday you came into the corner shop just after me? I paid with a 2-shilling piece, and Mrs. Goldman's ready to swear she gave it to you two as change. You don't still have it by any chance?"
I felt Gary jump.
No, sorry," he said. "We must have spent it." "Was it special then?" I couldn't help asking.
"It was the first money I ever earned," Mr. Tate said. "I took it home to give to my mother, but she said to keep it for good luck. I've had it in my waistcoat pocket ever since. Not always the same waistcoat."
That may well have been Mr. Tate's first joke. I've often wondered since if he ever realised exactly the kind of luck his first wages had brought him. I've also wondered what his first employer was like. Although I think I can guess. That was Old Money by Jan Mark. It was abridged for radio by Peter Kerry and read by Malcolm Rayburn. Old Money was produced in Manchester by Martin Jameson.